Okay, today's reading is from Acts 17, 24 to 27. The God who made the world and everything in it, being the Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us.
Good morning, everyone. How are you doing this morning? Good. A few administrative things before we get on with our sermon. Not only is it Amos's son's baptism today, it's his 84th birthday. So you can all give him lots of birthday bumps. When we were growing up, we called Amos Father Time because he was the first of us to leave his teens, and he's just getting old. So wish him well on his birthday today. Secondly, special welcome to Travis and Lori Johnson. Good to see you guys. They're in the back, handsome man, beautiful woman back there. They were my pastors in Strathmore before we moved here, and Travis was a picture of servant-heartedness and just loved us so well. Every Monday in a discipleship school, Ryan and I would go into his office, and he would look us in the eyes with love and grace and go, "What were you thinking? Like, why would you do that?" as he heard the reports of our weekend shenanigans, but nevertheless loved us and was kind to us. So it's really great to have you guys, and Jackie, good to see you here. And lastly, is the graphic up? Is Tannis Wall here? Tannis Wall, or Tannis Leach? It's almost like I didn't marry them myself. Tannis Leach just serves our church wonderfully with graphic design and really cares for everything she does. And so we tasked her with fitting 5 individual graphics into one logo and just did amazing. So we're getting reports all week about how amazing this is. So thank you for that. And sorry about the name mishap. It's in no way prophetic. I promise. I said it isn't. It isn't prophetic. Seriously. Looking for the worst, all of you. Just kidding. The last week we started our glorious church series, our 5 passions, and we looked at Ephesians 5, 24 to 27 to kick us off, and we just meditated and marveled at the glorious church, that God absolutely just loves his bride, that he cherishes her, he nourishes her, and he will love his church into just something of beauty and magnificence, and he's called the church to be sanctified, to be set apart only for him, and in being set apart only for him, it means to walk in a way that Christ walked, to prioritize the things that Christ prioritized. And in doing so, he promises that he'll take his bride and he'll fill her with his own glory. But we can't miss the point that he just desperately wants us to be like him. And so we'll look over the coming 8 or 10 weeks at the priorities of Christ throughout the scriptures. That the New Testament is full of what the apostles prioritized. In following Jesus, they said these are the things that should exemplify Christian living. These are the things that every Christ follower should be like because it looks like Jesus himself. And so for the next 2 weeks, the first passion we're going to be looking at is the passion for the presence of God. And so our text today that Kaylee read is full of amazing theological truths about God. And I feel like for some of us, this passage is going to have some real prophetic purpose for our season that we're currently in. That God is calling you right here and right now into something new with him. And he's wanting to shift our lives and draw us into himself and draw us into his manifest presence in a more real and tangible way. And the manifest presence of God, indeed, it is the true marking of the church. that the church is the temple of God. It's the place where his glory is dwelling on earth, and it's his covenant community, and his utmost desire is to fill his community with himself. And so in Acts 17, if we just look at our text this morning, Paul is in the city of Athens. He's brought to a place called the Areopagus, which is kind of where the top philosophers and rhetoricians came together, and kind of like a council, they'd get together and they'd deliberate and they'd debate things, and oftentimes it functioned in kind of a judicial way, that they would make decisions, and they were the intelligent group of that city. And so on this occasion, Paul finds himself there, and he has the opportunity to join in with them and discuss his theological views on who God is. And so he begins in verse 22 before our text with this observation that Athens is an incredibly religious city. They have idols everywhere. He goes in the marketplaces and the streets, and there's idols and there's temples. And if you look through history, Athens was actually regarded as the most religious city in history. And Paul is really not actually commending them for this. He's kind of noting their superstitious nature. And so he's going, everywhere I look, everywhere, you just have this whole city full of temples, full of altars, full of idols. And amongst these altars is this one altar that he notices that just says, to the unknown God. There's an altar set up to the unknown God, which is kind of an interesting thing. An altar for a God they don't know, an altar for a God that they don't understand in any way. But in the Roman empire, they'd have something called the Pantheon of Gods. So when you'd defeat another nation, you would just adopt their God into your worship, because you wouldn't want to miss out on a God that's more powerful than your God. So if you don't want to take that risk of there even being a God you're ignorant of that's more powerful than the God you worshipped. And you definitely wouldn't want to exclude a God from worship that is better than the God you worship. So they would have an altar just kind of as a catch-all to go, there's an altar for a God we don't know, we don't understand, but just in case he's stronger than our God, we should probably worship him. And so Paul naturally sees this as a really good opportunity to acknowledge their ignorance. He's going, you're right, there is a God you don't know about, and he is, in fact, more powerful and profoundly more superior to all of the gods you worship. So this is Paul's kind of speech to them. So we'll read the text together again. He says, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God, and in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. So a few themes I want to pull out quickly before we get into the main thrust of the sermon, but there are two kind of theological truths about the nature of God. And in some ways, they're at tension. They seem paradoxical to one another, that God is both transcendent and yet he's immanent. So that means that God is both beyond our comprehension. He is outside of everything in creation. He exists eternally outside of time and space. He's not limited by geography. He's not limited by his creation. He's not limited by time. He's entirely otherworldly. He's distinct. He's beyond what we can comprehend. He's holy. He's not relative to anything in creation. We can't compare something that we can comprehend to God because he's greater and more spectacular than anything we could even dream of. And everything we have comes from him. That he needs absolutely nothing from us. He is entirely content on his own. He is full. He's not lacking anything. In some ways, I think just on that point, I'm not going to preach this, but we could hear that again, that God doesn't need anything from us. You don't need to strive for his pleasure, for his love and his care, that he is not lacking something that we have to fulfill in him. He is completely and utterly content just in of himself. He's whole. He's beyond what we could even imagine wholeness is. And so Paul continues that you can't build a temple that can contain him. You can't have an idol that can contain God. That there is nothing he needs, and he doesn't need our service, and he doesn't actually need our worship. We need to serve him. We need to worship him. That we are created beings by God that fundamentally need to worship him. We are worshipful beings. And so Paul is looking out in Athens, which is just full of temple after temple, full of idols, and he's declaring, like, all of these things that you've set up to hold God can't contain him. He himself has given life. He himself has given creation, and he's in creation, and he's through it, and he's greater than it, and he's unlimited in every single way. He is the absolute supreme Lord of lords. He's the God of heaven and earth. His lordship is utterly universal, and all other gods have to bow before his supremacy. That is beautiful. This is how he starts his speech. And we need this majestic, holy, massive view of God. We can't lose this aspect of who he is. That this is the God we pray to. This is the God we seek after. This is the God that we love. That he's powerful and mighty and holy and transcendent and beyond everything we could imagine or dream or conceive. That we'll spend the rest of our lives getting to know him more, and we'll never even come close to maxing out who he is. That the most we could ever know God is still like dipping our toe in the depths of a lake in the mountains that's so deep no one could ever get to the bottom. It's all just dipping our foot in and never coming close to all of the reality that God is in and of himself. Spectacular. And yet, on the other side of this truth is that God is imminent, which means he's near to us. He's close to us. This is exactly what Paul says at the end of this passage. Yet, he's actually not far from each one of us, which is amazing. This God who is profoundly holy and distinct from us and greater than us and unimaginable is near to us. He's close. He's accessible. He's relational. He's so far from distant. And so it doesn't, like, however we come into church, it can feel like God's distant. But this God who is holy and outside of everything we can imagine is paradoxically at the exact same time so intimately near to you this morning. It's the beauty of the incarnation. That God takes on flesh. Jesus comes down from heaven, holy, perfect, glorified, takes on the humility of humanity, despite his majesty, becomes a servant of all, despite our shame, despite our guilt, despite our brokenness, and he brings us into himself, into this perfect, mystical union of oneness, of closeness, of intimacy. This is our call as a church, is to be in God's presence, to have the dwelling place of God amongst us. It's his plan from all time for this, to be amongst his people powerfully, in a real, manifest way. God has chosen to be amongst his people as a friend, as a father, with affection, caring, loving, removing all guilt, removing all shame, anything that would separate us from his love, he takes it upon himself and says, no, come into me and experience my love fully. This God who is transcendent and pure and holy wants to know and be known. He wants to be known by you. He wants to be present in your life. He doesn't want to be at a distance. He doesn't want to be unapproachable. And I really think that these tensions have to be appreciated and they have to be kept, that understanding one makes the other so much more remarkable. We can have a view of God that he's just big and he's glorious and he's out there, but he's not for relationship. Or we can have the other view that he's just kind of my buddy and he's my friend, but there's actually nothing remarkable or special or holy about him. And we can find ourselves on either end of these tensions and miss this beautiful aspect of God that he's both. He's so far outside of what we can imagine and yet goes, I want to be with you and I want to know you and I want you to know me. this transcendent God, this incomprehensible God who created heaven and earth, knows you, and he cares for you, and he loves you, and he wants to be known by you. And none of it is for selfish gain. He doesn't need you, and he's not completed by us. But the beauty of that is that his love and his relationship and his intimacy is entirely by choice. That he desires it, he wills it, and he wants it. It's grace, it's desire. And yet when we're realistic about our relationship with God, we know that he can feel distant. It doesn't always feel like he's close to us. It doesn't always feel like he wants to be known by us. His presence can feel fleeting. It can feel unknown. And our experiences within the presence of God can feel vastly different from day to day. Sometimes it's just undeniable and powerful, and it's so obvious that God is with you. And at other times, it's gentle or quiet, still, sometimes silent. And you have to go, why? If God is everywhere, if he's in everything and through everything, if he's powerful and mighty and glorious, yet wanting to be with us and wanting to be close to us, why does it sometimes feel like he's not there at all? Because I think if we're honest with ourselves, we've probably all had that thought. God, are you actually here? Do you actually care about what I'm going through? Because you could fix it, but you're not. And I think this passage has some really good answers for us. Let's look again at verse 26 and 27 together. It says, "And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us." In God's sovereignty and providence, he has set every nation of mankind to live on the earth. That he has determined their allotted times. He has determined times of blessing and times of favor. He's actually determined their geographical realities. That God knows within creation where these nations of people will exist. He's arranged time and space for everyone on the earth. So I think if you can think about it in a national way, which the Bible says is true, then we can probably see where that logic follows and think about it on a personal level as well. That God has chosen every one of us to be alive, living, moving here right now. That I was chosen to be born to my parents in Elmer, Ontario in 1984. Out of all the times and all the places that I could have existed in all of creation, God said, no, I want Stephen to exist here and now for a reason. And the same is true for all of you, that God has planned for you to be here, that he's planned for you to be in this age of life, that he's planned for you to be in this country, in this city. He's ordained for you to be in your current communities today. He's ordained for you to be at the current job you're at today, or in school, or wherever you find yourself in life, that God has known everything. He's over everything, and he says, I want them here now. We can go even smaller than just our lives. I would guess that God has you in specific circumstances right now. That you are experiencing life experiences, you're facing trials for a specific purpose right now that he knows everything about. And maybe even right now the experiences you're in are really bad. And it's really crucial to go, why is this happening to me now? And God feels really distant. And this is Paul's answer, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way towards him and find him. Yet he is not actually far from each one of us. God desires to be with us. He desires to be present. And he wants to be known by us. And he has positioned your life to be where it is right now in this way for you to seek after him. He desires to be sought after by his people. We don't seek after him just to get something. It's not just for blessing, but he's wooing us in to love and intimacy. He's not manipulating us. He doesn't put us in hardship to manipulate us into love, but he knows what they actually need more than anything in all of life is me. And as a church, we are people who are our fundamental calling. The core of who we are is to be a people of his presence, a people who know God, a people who love God with all we have, a people who have the desire for God to dwell powerfully in our midst week after week. And at times, this passage is showing us that he will lead us into situations. He will bring us to very specific circumstances in time and space in order that we seek him out, in order that we pray and fast and worship, in order that we spend time in the words and really get in the face of God. It's actually the love of God that does this. It's him knowing that we need his power, but we also need his gentleness. We need his holiness, and we need his compassion. But this desire, I think, is one that way too often we try to circumvent, or we try to work around God's involvement. That he puts us in times and places to seek after him, and we ignore that, and we try to do it on our own. And inevitably, we're left frustrated. We're left incomplete. We're left with our lives feeling the sense of unresolved, that we can ignore the very areas that God is trying to bring us into his love and say, well, that sucks. I want nothing to do with it, so I'm going to try my best to go over here and figure life out. When in the reality is going, I've actually ordained all of this just so that you feel some sort of sense to seek me out, because you'll find me, because I'm not far from you. He has ordained your lives and your callings and your seasons in such a way that it draws you into his love and into his intimacy, that he puts us in positions in life that necessitate us finding him, where it's just beyond what we can figure out on our own. So I'd ask you all to let him speak to you. What are the areas today? What's happening in your life today over the past few weeks that actually has God's fingertips and his fingerprints all over it? That if you take a step back and look at it from his perspective and look at it with the invitation to come and find him, you go, wow, all of this is actually just so I seek him, and all I've done is everything other than that. It's entirely possible, if we look at the Athenians, to be very religious and yet be very far from God. That it's possible in a really scary way. That in a superstitious way, we can pass that off as Christianity, but entirely miss the point. We can go to church, we can read the Bible, we can attend community functions, we can go through Corpus, and yet be entirely self-reliant and never actually seek after the face of God. Never actually just want God for God. Just want him because he's amazing and loving and kind. We can have a form of Christianity that is void of relationship, that is just temples and altars and fake worship. When he's going, I actually just want your heart. He's going, I actually want you to be face to face with me. I want you to be in my presence. He wants us to know him with passion. He wants us to lay our lives before him, vulnerable and open, fully giving ourselves to him in every way, with complete trust and reliance. We would risk everything we are and have to know him more. We can be religious and miss him entirely. And I think too often seeking God is our absolute last case scenario. It's the last thing I do. When I have a problem, I will find every possible way that I can fix it myself. And I do it instinctively. I'm not going, I don't want God. I go, okay, this happens. I need to figure out how to pay for this, how to fix this, how to do these things, and never actually let that situation be something that draws me into his love and draws me into his goodness. It's only when I failed 100 times trying to fix it myself that I go, maybe I should pray. Maybe I should seek the face of God. Maybe I should then try to find peace and hope and comfort in him. once I've completely exhausted all other opportunities. We don't see the situations of life with the lens of sovereignty and providence that says God's actually in control and he's reigning over everything. That I have nothing to fear and nothing to doubt because he's good and he's holy and he's powerful and he's over all gods. He's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Perhaps I should just seek him first because he actually knows what I need better than I know what I need. We'll find it in our marriages. We don't want to do this. In work, with neighbors, with friends, with church community. We don't want to let our situations lead us to God first. We want us to be right first. And we want God's will to line up with our will. But the beauty of this text is it shows this beautiful, magnificent view of God and goes, this is the God that wants to just be with you as a priority over everything else. He just wants your heart, he wants your life, and he wants to draw you in through your life circumstances, into relationship, and into his very presence. And God has brought you here right now, that you are sitting in this building, and whatever you are facing, friends, is an invitation to draw near to him this morning. That Christian maturity is actually doing this first. It's to believe that we are sold out for the presence of God, that we want him and him alone, and not because of what it does for us, but because we know that he is just worth loving with all of our hearts. We need to be quick to seek after him every day, throughout the day, finding God, because he's not far from us. He's near. And his love will draw you into his presence and into his goodness. This God that's beyond our comprehension just really loves us and wants to be with us, desires to know you, and desires for you to know him. And so as Bishop Todd comes to the table this morning, let's just spend a moment in prayer. Because I think if we ask God for his perspective, that there is a heavenly perspective on every situation that we're currently in, that's probably different than the approach we're looking at. There's real need, there's real pain, and there's real suffering in this room, and I don't want to minimize that. But perhaps that is actually an invitation into his love and into his goodness this morning, not the absence of it. Not that he's distant and forgotten about you, but he is actually drawing you into something greater and something more. Let's just bow our hearts in prayer. So Jesus, we thank you for everything you've done. We put our hope and our trust in you alone, Jesus. We know that you have called every person in this room, in this time and in this season, to this place today for a reason. None of this is accidental. None of this is happenstance, but we trust in your power and your might. So, Father, would you, by your Spirit, just show us the areas of our lives, our circumstances, that are actually an invitation into your goodness, into your intimacy, into your love. Show us our self-reliance. Show us where we've neglected you, where you have been our last choice. Jesus, as we approach you at your table, as we partake of your manifest presence in the bread and wine, would you draw so near to us with love and with comfort and with peace, that this church would know the presence of God.